All right.
Janet O'Shea is professor of, let me read this out, professor of world arts and cultures or dance at UCLA. And we're talking to each other now in our various time zones under lockdown. Hello, Janet, how are you doing?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm wearing my UCLA boxing
I
t-shirt.
saw that. That's pretty awesome. Yes, I'm very pleased to see that
Apparently, it's
you're.
quite rare and quite. I just asked. I hassled Paul McCarthy, who's head of the martial arts. And I said, "You got to get me something. Can I buy something?" And he said, "I'll give you this." So it's a collector's item. So I'm wearing that for you. You are. Let me share the screen. I've just been looking at your. I've been reading your book again today. I've read it more than once. I've just been flicking through it in the garden. But your website at UCLA shows that you do a huge range of things in terms of your teaching, and you teach all kinds of things on dance history, food politics, PhD writing, theories of corporeality, martial arts films, lots on empowerment phenomenology. And you've written stacks and stacks of stuff, more and more it seems about martial arts, but you're professor of dance, is that right?
That's right. So I was, I mean, technically, I'm a professor of world arts and cultures slash dance, which is probably the most unwieldy title imaginable. But I was hired as a dance historian, and my PhD is in dance history and theory. So even though I'm not really writing about anymore, I still see that attention to the body and like an attention to what commitments bodies engage in through movement as being central.
Okay, cool. You glitched a little bit there. So if the Wi-Fi goes glitchy, I'll just start talking again, and then but it's a risk. We're very far away from each other at the moment. But so it was dance and culture first, and then you came to martial arts later, or when did you discover the martial arts?
So I actually, I grew up in the 70s, and Bruce Lee was an icon, as everyone knows, of the 70s, right alongside Evel Knievel and Farrah Fawcett.
Evel Knievel.
Didn't expect to hear that within
No, I
the
didn't.
first time I heard you. Yeah. So it was this thing, I grew up like adoring Bruce Lee, just as everybody did, but I didn't make that connection until I was in college. A friend of mine had studied a little Jeet Kune Do and was super into Bruce Lee's reading. And like, he was doing Kung Fu at I can't remember what style of Kung Fu, but it was, a couple of towns over. And I went and took a couple of classes. I was like, okay, this is interesting. But I always had this thing of like, I'm gonna study martial arts. And when I moved to San Francisco after college, I started studying Chuo Lei Fut, which I was kind of into. I mean, it didn't really ignite the spark for me, but I certainly enjoyed it. And then I broke a toe in a sparring match and realized that this was not so great in terms of my performance career because I was actively performing dance a lot. So I kind of put that on the back burner. A few years later, I started studying Wing Chun in my friend's backyard, which was amazing, but I was in grad school at the time. I was very busy. And then I got another opportunity to study in Los Angeles in my Sifu's backyard, which was, it felt like something out of a Hong Kong action movie. There were like six of us in this, little yard out in the San Gabriel Valley. And for some reason, when I moved to the UK for my first job, I stopped training. And I don't really know why, because obviously there's plenty of martial arts in Britain, but it's just sort of how it played out. So when I moved back to Los Angeles and started at UCLA, I saw they had a Jeet Kune Do class. And then it was like all the light bulbs went on. And I was like, oh, right. I had actually started studying Wing Chun because of the Bruce Lee connection. And I was like, I actually have the opportunity to study the art of Bruce Lee. And so that's when I like really got the martial arts bug. And it really became an obsession. But it had kind of always been there as an interest, for many years, kind of just running, it was running alongside and secondary to dance
Okay.
until
When did,
recently.
when was the what was the first thing that you what was the first article you wrote? What was the first paper you gave on something to do with martial arts?
Oh, huh. I have to stop and think about that.
You know, I think, you know, when I first started writing about martial arts, I didn't think it was going to be an academic pursuit. Yeah. I thought I was writing a memoir. And actually, even before I thought I was writing a memoir, I was just sort of keyboarding, you know, I was just sort of banging out ideas that were coming to me. And I think I got the idea to write about martial arts in an academic way. I think it was a colleague of mine, Cheryl Dodds, was working on the Oxford Handbook of Dance and Competition.
Okay.
And she approached me and said, are you interested in writing for this? And I was sort of like, you know, my background is in writing about Indian classical dance. So
yeah,
what's the connect? And then I was like, oh, wait a second. Okay, I get it. Right. She's asking me to write about martial arts. That's a really interesting idea. And then I was thinking like, yeah, actually, a lot of the martial arts I'm studying are competitive practices. They're basically sports. Sure, here we go. So I think that was probably the first kernel of the writing about martial arts.
Okay. Would you say that this monograph, Risk, Failure, Play, What Dance Reveals About Martial Arts Training, did this come out last year? Was this 2019 or was this?
Yeah. Well, it came out in October 2018, but it was 18.
Okay. Oh, but the date on it is 19. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I like it. I like it when they do that. It stays new for a long time, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes, yes, indeed.
So,
yes.
Is this a kind of culmination of a project, is of something, or is it just an ongoing, you know, statement in a much longer conversation with yourself and with the world?
It's a culmination of sorts. I think the set of writing that I was doing had a lot to do with trying to make sense of what was the appeal of this practice for me and for the people who I was training with. And how did it manage to build, you know, these extraordinary horizontal bonds among people who are otherwise unconnected? Mm-hmm. And I found this really interesting because so many of the people I'm training with and alongside, or, you know, I was until recently, are amateurs. You know, some of them are aspiring instructors, but a lot of them, you know, none of them are competitors. None of them are pro fighters. And even people who are aspiring instructors, very often they're doing that alongside something else. So it's this, you know, it's an avocation. It's an avocation that inspires total dedication. And then it was also, you know, more qualitative than that, the kind of sense of this extraordinary experiences of collaboration that you can find in the midst of intense competition. And that competition being very immediate, because it's for a 3-minute round and then it's done. So it's not like a sporting match, you know, where the competition is really staged and a lot builds up to it. So I think it was really about getting at that kind of question. And I still have a lot of other questions about martial arts and about physicality and all sorts of other things. But I think this project kind of was a culmination of that inquiry.
Okay. And you I mean, the title is, it's Risk, Failure, Play. So you, I mean, the argument is, it's got at least three dimensions, hasn't it? And then there's the silent sort of fourth dimension, which is competitiveness or competition, which isn't quite in the title, but it's never far away. Can you give us a pot summary of, I guess, the major or one of the major arguments, or your, you know, the thing that stands out most for you? How would you kind of encapsulate the book?
So I would say the argument of the book is that play gives us techniques for managing difficult realities with intelligence. Mm-hmm. And that physical play, because of its intensity, does that in a particularly immediate kind of way and potentially particularly effective kind of way. In the case of martial arts, the difficult reality that we're dealing with is the human capacity for violence. And so I think that makes it a really interesting case to look at through the lens of play. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it opens up to all of these other questions, like, so what are these techniques that play gives us? How does play give us these techniques? And, you know, one of the things that I come back to in the book over and over again is, like, play gives us these techniques for managing difficult realities, but it doesn't always fulfill that promise. Yeah. And that has to do partially with how play is structured and the institutional structures around it, and of course the economics and also the interpersonal dynamics, but it's also about what we do with it and how we interpret it. So in addition to competition, the other kind of sub-theme running through this is reflection. Like if we're reflective about our practice of play or our experience of play, it can help us imagine other ways of being in the world.
Okay, so you mean, I mean, you explore and you mean lots of different things when you talk about play, because you mean experimentation, you mean enjoyment, just like, so you mean something, it's something that shades into the competitive, but while staying collaborative. So the way in which you might, when you're sparring or when you know, when you have a new sparring partner, you suss each other out, you might assert dominance or you might work out who's dominant, and then it can become more playful and more collaborative, and it's like the training is a reward in and of itself because you're both involved in something that's mutually pleasurable, mutually challenging. But if there's a massive imbalance, then the person who's dominant won't just keep pounding the other person. They'll kind of say, why not, have you thought about doing this, or have you thought about, so you mean lots of different stuff. And I guess, I mean, which is the dominant sense of play that interests you, or is it all of the possible senses of play?
Both, I think. You know, I think it's one of those, the answer to that question is yes, because I think on the one hand, when I talk about play, I'm focused really on that primary definition of play is something that's intrinsically valuable. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's an activity of teaching and learning, like what you've just talked about with a good sparring partner, right? And like it's an amazing thing when you find a new good sparring partner and you can see that process happening where you're sussing each other out. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh yeah, we're not going too easy on each other so that nothing happens, but we're not going so hard on each other that we can't figure out where the space of teaching and learning is. So I'm thinking about play in terms of being intrinsically valuable. The experience is intrinsically valuable, but then I do also explore all these other meanings, such as the association of play as in movement within a system, play as in to exercise skill, and then going into the, like, what is the difference between play, games, and sports? Mm-hmm. And for me, it was important to make that distinction. To think about play as being more open-ended, to think about games in terms of open games versus closed games, and how games have rules, and how sports are institutionalized. But also, my goal wasn't to say, like, oh, this is play over here, and this is unstructured, and it's good, and then these are games, and these sort of discipline us, and then there's sports that are bad, because I recognize that the spirit of play runs through all of those things, and that's, in fact, what makes it complicated and interesting to think about.
So you also argue, in the book and elsewhere, that it's like play has an interest because it's one of those things that's culturally kind of devalued. People think that grown-ups don't play, that play is for children or play is for puppies or kittens. But your argument implies that hierarchizing of like the idea that adults are serious and it's always a project and it always has an outcome and it always has a purpose, that's simply not kind of, it's not true, but when it's enforced as true, that there can be sometimes negative or socially deleterious consequences, like to do with individualism and to do with the profit motive and so on. So play is everywhere, but society tries to make us believe that adults do serious stuff. Adults don't play. Is that right? Is that a fair representation?
Yeah, very, very much so. And I think one of the crucial points here is that, and this is something I draw from my experience in dance studies, is dance is also something that's trivialized in this society.
Oh, yeah.
And we see dance as being frivolous and decorative, and it's mere entertainment. And I think a similar thing happens with play. And I think that that's not incidental, because both of those things are about the imagination and creativity, and then both of them are also often tied to the body. Yeah. So I think, yeah, you've identified one of the core problems that I was grappling with, no pun intended, in the book, which is that we do tend to think about play as being something that is appropriate for children or maybe for the elderly, right? Yeah. Like it's okay once you're retired to go sit in the park and play chess. Mm-hmm. But for everyone else, they need to be serious and buckle down and get on with things. And even our play is structured, you know, so that, well, it's okay to play if you're on a soccer team in high school, or it's okay as an adult to go to the gym, right? But you're still, there's an idea that we're supposed to kind of work at play in the sense we're supposed to wear our Fitbits and, you know, we're supposed to be tracking this. And I think it is deleterious to society, you know, to individuals and to society, because if we look at all the kinds of opportunities that play creates, such as the ability to manage risk or to navigate failure or to consider our own vulnerability, to experience skills acquisition, if we, and as well as the interpersonal, to be able to navigate these sort of interpersonal relationships and to develop a sense of fairness, really, that if we don't have that and we're not living that out on a regular basis, then that has some serious detriments, you know, for society potentially.
And you mentioned the other two key coordinates of the main title, which is risk and failure. I mean, I think that anyone who's committed to something physical like martial arts, which if it involves sparring, or I guess things which involve performance, like learning how to do a new thing with your body, or indeed learning how to do a new thing. The expression is, you know, the common expression in martial arts circles is you either win or you learn. You know, so like you might win, but if you haven't learned anything, then kind of what's the point? And actually failure has an important status in all martial training, because you should learn from it. And why does that keep going wrong? And that is the kind of condition of your growth and development.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other adage is a master has failed more times than a beginner has even tried. Right. And that's another one of those adages in martial arts that I think is so important. And, you know, I think in a way, like when you asked about, like, is this project a culmination or what did this project come out of? And I was saying, well, it kind of is functioning as a memoir. But the other thing is that it's a kind of sustained intellectual engagement with the idea that martial arts gives us life lessons. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's like such a kind of truism in martial arts. And we get a lot of that from, like, you know, every martial art, from the most competitive modern martial art to the most traditional, like it's embedded in it is always this idea that it's going to teach you how to handle your regular life. Mm-hmm. And of course, as we know, it doesn't always work that way. But I'm super interested in, first of all, when it does work, how it works. But then also, like, what's underneath those life lessons that are supposed to be there? Like, what is embedded in that idea of the life lessons? And I think that idea of, like, you either win or you learn is a classic. Like, that can be applied to any moment in life.
I mean, I think it's such a hard thing to, on the one hand, both to know and to believe. Like, as martial artists, we can believe that it improves us. And that we, you know, it's strengthened us, or it's helped us to be more playful, even, or to be more tolerant, or to be more chilled out, or to able to cope. But I mean, there's a number of challenges in that. For instance, I just reviewed an article for a journal, and the argument of the article was basically a reiteration of that belief that somehow, I'm not going to mention even the martial styles, just I don't want to cause offense to anyone, but it was just a repetition of the argument that it improves you and it makes you a good person. Now, this is a claim that we hear a lot. It's also a claim that we might believe on one level, like the classic, like, there was a thug, they start martial arts training, they become a more honorable person or a more decent person, or they move away from violence or crime. Okay. But it doesn't necessarily work like that. I mean, the dynamics are so much more complex, aren't they? We can't just accept as scholars that somehow you enter a discipline, you get a lot of endorphins, you get a lot of satisfaction, you get a lot of personal and physical growth and development, and you're therefore morally good, right? It's a really complex field, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that is why I wrote this book. You know, because on the one hand, like, we see that martial arts can bring with it these benefits. so many people do have these stories of how they've been transformed, and so many, so many high-level martial artists, not all of them, but so many of them are actually that, are emblematic of being the peaceful warrior, you know, probably more than who are not, right? But we can't, as you say, we can't just assume that it's going to work, or that it that it works organically or magically without any additional effort on our part, or without attending to, like, how is the training structured? What is the ethos of the gym? How does the coach behave? How do the students relate to each other? What do they take home from their experiences? So I think for each of these things, for each of these components, first of all, identifying the components for me was really important. So if it's true that, like, sometimes martial arts can make us, say, more peaceful or more reflective, or can cause us to have a shorter fuse, if that's true, how does that work? What are the elements of that? And then also, what do we have to do with those elements? Mm-hmm. And this book isn't a how-to, you know, or it isn't like a kind of applied scholarship in terms of, like, here's how to structure your gym. Mm-hmm. But what it is an inquiry into each of these things, saying, like, these may be some of the elements that enable martial arts to effectively transmit life lessons. But more importantly, we can find this in any practice if we're attentive. Mm-hmm. And then also, it's really important to, I think, to emphasize that, like, each of these elements are not something that I'm saying, like, with failure, for example. Now we have this whole idea that, like, we're failure deprived and people just need to fail up and we need to have soft landings, and, you know, kids today, they just don't have enough resilience. And it's like, that's insane. We live in a society where there's no, you know, particularly in the United States, we have no safety net. People have a really good reason to be failure averse. Right. So it's not to say, like, hey, just expose yourself to failure. It's to say, like, look, failure is actually painful. Mm. It's a negative experience almost in any situation, because that idea of you either win or you learn is, when you learn, you've learned through some pretty painful experiences that might involve physical injury. They certainly involve emotional damage or disappointment. So if we want to accept that failure is part of life, then we have to create, I think, have to create the parameters by which we can withstand failure. Mm-hmm. We can't just ask that individuals be more resilient, because then we're just falling into that, like, neoliberal frame where, like, the individuals just have to bear the responsibility for everything. Yeah. So I think what I was setting up there is a kind of framework for thinking through those ideas that, like, okay, martial arts, and it's not just martial arts. I think we could probably make this argument about a lot of physical activities, mm-hmm. but martial arts is kind of interesting because it traffics in the components of violence. So it makes it a particularly interesting case, I think. But it's really about digging into those components and saying, like, okay, are these the elements that allow us to take from play a kind of skill set that allows us to navigate the rest of our lives? And if so, how are those built up? And what do then we need to do as practitioners to reflect back on our experience to then learn from it?
Okay, so you've you mentioned violence, and you mentioned the exploration of the different factors involved, like what is in play that produces these outcomes, whether that be, let's say, a resilience or a short fuse, or, you know, a propensity to violence, or a tendency to withdraw from violence or pacify, or any of the other possible results. What is it that causes that? And I know that you've got, you kind of have two different sorts of fields of interest, and one is social, scientific, and cultural, and you're interested in the social dynamics of a gym or a dojo or a class or a club. And does that produce maybe toxic masculinity, for instance, or is it exclusionary? But you also have another aspect, which is your interest in the cognitive and the scientific sides of things. Are they different projects? Do you one day do you look at the scientific work, and next day are you thinking about social dynamics, or how do those two things fit together?
I'm mostly interested in social dynamics. I got super interested for a while in scientific questions, particularly related, initially it was related to neuroscience, because theories of neuroplasticity, and actually epigenetics, but that's a whole other thing, which I don't know very much about. So let's just, I'll talk about neuroscience for now. Theories of neuroplasticity were beginning to reveal the specifics of how the self is created through experience. And I thought that was super interesting because there's a way in which science has, through its own discoveries, developed a way of questioning its own empiricism. And I became very interested in how the self being constructed through experience was related to neuroscientific theories of consciousness, which when I followed it, I kind of went down this rabbit hole and followed this along, ending up at neuroscience and phenomenology. So I got super interested in that because I had already been interested in phenomenology and the idea of developing, creating a self through physical experience and creating these interpersonal and relational connections. And so this kind of led me to this question, and in saying that science was can challenge its own empiricism, I'm not making a kind of what I see as a sort of like older post-structuralist argument that science is all a construct. Like, I think we're living at a moment, like right now, very clearly, where we need to take the contributions of science quite seriously. I mean, that's completely obvious because we're living in a pandemic, but also in relation to the climate crisis and various other conditions that are material. And we need the scientific analysis of the specificities of that, but we also need to recognize, I think, as scholars and also as citizens, that these problems can't only be solved scientifically. The COVID-19 pandemic cannot be solved only through scientific intervention. And we're seeing that like so literally where it's like, well, if there even is going to be a vaccine, it's like a year to 18 months away. So we have to find actually social and cultural solutions to the situation that we're in. And the climate crisis is another one of these. So the issue that I think about in relation to the sciences is what is the contribution of the humanities in a time of crisis? And how do we take that attention to specificity that is so important to the sciences? How do we negotiate with it while recognizing, while not falling into scientism, right? And not like falling into that idea that as soon as you decide that science is the only answer, then you only pose scientific questions or questions that can be answered through science. So I think it comes back to that question of like, what is the role of the humanities at a time of crisis?
Okay, and do you think that, I think we're well past the time when the stereotype of a very hard border between the sciences and the social sciences, or between the sciences and the humanities, is plausible. Do you think that scientific research responds to social and cultural theories, and or what's the relationship? I mean, you talk about phenomenology and neuroscience. So phenomenology to me was always a sort of, I thought it was a philosophical paradigm, you know, before I had read any. I was, oh, this is a philosophical paradigm, as opposed to a scientific paradigm. So, I mean, what kind of relationships do you work with, or within, or do you transgress? What kind of borders are there?
Well, I think the phenomenological question is really interesting because the neuroscientists who go in that direction are interested in consciousness. And they're interested in theories of mind and looking at whether consciousness is simply reducible to the physical. And the people I've become really interested in are the ones who have moved towards phenomenology because they recognize that consciousness is special and it's different from other kinds of brain functions. So David Chalmers talks about the easy questions and the hard questions. And he talks about the easy questions in neuroscience being how something works, right? Like you can map something out in terms of how it works in the brain, but the hard question is why. Why it works that way, why it feels the way it does, why it arises in the first place. And you know, he's very careful about saying like the easy questions aren't really that easy. So it's totally fine that neuroscientists have devoted their entire lives to figuring that out. But the hard questions are even harder. And I think for me, I would then add to that, that there's the question of why, and then there's the question of why does it matter? So I think it's very clear, I'm not the first person to say this, and I'm sure I will not be the last, that hard boundaries between the disciplines are, you know, can no longer be sustained, as you're saying. I think what is interesting about the kind of conversations that we're starting to have is like the questions of like, so how do we create those connections, right? And we recognizing that we all have, you know, finite resources in terms of time and effort. And I don't necessarily expect that scientists are going to be reading in detail in the humanities, or even that humanities people necessarily want to take a deep dive into science. But it's to recognize that we're at a particular moment in time where the questions of the cultural and the material are running up against each other, and they're entangled, and they're like tumbling over each other. And we really need to be able to approach this from the kind of angle that really helps us understand how integrated the cultural and the material are.
Okay. And just changing back to martial arts, how, in your perspective, could you draw lines between dance and martial arts? I mean, just in your practical experience, maybe, or your phenomenal experience, or in your conceptual universe, where can you draw a distinction, and how would you draw the distinction?
Yeah, I think for me, because I was trained in concert dance, I initially trained in like Western concert dance.
Frozen.
Jazz. And then when I went to college, I started learning contemporary dance. And then I moved very quickly into South Indian classical dance, a form called Bharatanatyam. What all those things have in common is, despite their enormous differences aesthetically and culturally, is that they're all concert dance forms. Mm-hmm. And they're all either, Bharatanatyam is a solo dance form, the other ones are like primarily ensemble dance forms, or where you have a group and a soloist, particularly contemporary dance. Mm-hmm. For me, the big difference with martial arts was the way it involved working with a partner. Now, this is not true for people who are social dancers, for example. Like, one of my main Filipino martial arts instructors is a swing dancer, and a couple of other people who I train with, one is a ballroom dancer. So the people who've done dance forms where they work with a partner, I don't think experience that kind of radical shift when they moved between dance and martial arts. But for me, working for a partner was such an extraordinary shift. And that idea that you could be working with a partner cooperatively in drills, but you're gradually upping it so that you do reach this point of failure eventually, and then moving towards sparring, where you're actually trying to oppose each other, you are opposing each other, you're trying to trip each other up, you're trying to fake each other out. Mm-hmm. That to me was a reality that was wholly separate from mm-hmm. my experience as a dancer. And again, it would be different if I was like a hip hop dancer and I was involved in breaking, or even if I was doing something like tango, right, where there's a bit of like one-upmanship. Mm-hmm. So that to me was the really big difference. I think if we think about it sort of phenomenologically, or if we think of it even sort of in terms of skills acquisition, there are a lot of similarities, and the major one is learning how to think with the body. That part of it, like as a dancer coming into a martial arts space, it didn't feel like it didn't feel alien in a certain kind of way. And also it helped that I was doing Indian classical dance and doing Wing Chun at the same time, because both of them are so angular, right? And it's just like, if you know, Bharatanatyam is like rotating out and Wing Chun is rotating in, but there's still that sense of angularity that enabled me to really have a very continuous movement experience. Okay. But even looking at it in a broader context, I think the whole idea of thinking with the body is so common to dance and martial arts that it was like it provided kind of a ground level.
Okay. I mean, I was struck by this a long time ago when I was doing Tai Chi, and a friend, a training partner, she brought one of her other friends down who was, they used to do tango. They did tango together, and she came down and she could straight away do push hands. This girl is, maybe she was 20, teenage girl, woman, who had never ever done Tai Chi or anything like it. But, and so she was learning she learned the form quite fast, but she could straight away instantly do push hands, because it's like in it, we would say listen, stick, yield, neutralize, right? So you listen metaphorically with your body, you sense where the other, and it was remarkable. It was I mean, astonishing. Like, she was beating me and I'd been doing it for a long time, you know. So anyway, there's another thing that I wanted to ask you about that I've been struck over the last couple of years, that you've tried really conscientiously to bring in concepts and issues in, like, really some really quite hardcore political theory, like some really, you know, Ernesto Laclau and Chantal Mouffe's work, to bring that to bear on issues in and around martial arts and martial arts and culture and society. What brought that together, thinking through political theory and martial arts?
You know, I think it comes from, again, like this really ground level experience. And that has to do with the timing of when I wrote the book and the timing of when I was training. And, you know, I think the subtitle of the book is What Dance Reveals About Martial Arts Training. But I think the subtitle could really be like, why I'm so disturbed by kids soccer and high school football. Because that's okay. Another sort of sub theme that I keep coming back to is like, what are we teaching kids, you know, when we have them engage in this hyper competitive kind of activity, and particularly when we get into things like high school and college athletics, where it starts to really become win at all costs. And, you know, when it's among a population that has a propensity towards violence towards other groups anyway, like young men athletes in high school, and then you tell them, okay, win at all costs, and what matters only is the camaraderie among the team, right? So there is a kind of that's sort of a through line, and I don't think the photos in the book, I may have used this at the talk I gave for martial arts studies, where it's like there was a sign at the soccer pitch at my local park here, like, you know, a stone's throw away, where the sign says, please remember, coaches are human, these are kids, this is not the World Cup, right? And that's a sign posted there permanently, which really gives a sense, I think, of the tragedy of what has happened around games in our societies. That they have become turned into this space that's not about unity or working together, or, you know, you either win or you learn, or, hey, you know, we won, but the losing side occasioned our victory, right? It becomes this kind of win at all costs, but the people who don't win are losers, right? And the parallel to our political situation, particularly in the United States, just seems so obvious to me that I almost couldn't help but talk about it. I mean, looking at what was happening in 2016, not just the Trump campaign, but this idea that, you know, it's not about a fair contest. It's not about, let's see what the voters decide. It's all about, let's see if we can rig the system. So let's see if we can just get the votes that'll tip the Electoral College, or let's try to make sure people can't get to the polls, or, you know, let's make it harder for certain people, certain populations to vote. And then, like what happened in North Carolina, where the outgoing governor actually changed the rules, right? So there's this idea of like an older notion of fairness has been eroded. And I think that sense of fairness that is put forward in liberal democracies is a very kind of, through these very sporting metaphors, right? Of like, you get in there and you compete, and then like the best person wins, but then you carry forward with the sense of unity. And like, that's problematic in some ways, because it's focused on the individual and on competition. But it's also, if that's eroded, we have some very serious problems if it's eroded without replacing it with something else. And so, Alongside that, I was reading Francesco Duina's book about competition, and he has this whole thing where he did research in Scandinavia. He was talking about how, you know, Scandinavians are super into their football teams, but they think about them very differently. So they get in there and they play that competitive sport, and they do this, you know, when they're kids and when they're in high school and, you know, as adults, but they define it differently. They think about it as an opportunity for unity. And of course, as I mentioned in the book, like, I'm not holding up Scandinavia as the perfect example, because Scandinavian countries are notoriously exclusive, but it's an interesting way to think about how the activity of competition can be redefined. Mm-hmm. So I've been alongside writing this book, I've been very interested in agonistics for a while. And what I was noticing is that what was happening around the 2016 point is that we had this real erosion of an idea of fair play.
Okay.
And it was also, you know, it also parallels what's happening economically. Like, the capitalist model of competition is deeply flawed in a lot of ways, but now we've gone to a hyper-capitalist model where, like, we're not even going to pretend there's a level playing field. And if you think of, like, go back to, like, the history of capitalism and to Adam Smith, it's not supposed to be not about corporatism. It's supposed to be about having this level playing field. And continually we see throughout time that it's not possible, like true capitalism isn't possible, because if you really want to keep competition going, you have to have some kind of intervention to keep some modicum of fairness. And so looking at the political theory and the economic, it came about because it's an interest of mine, but really it came about because of the timing of when I was writing this. And it almost felt like I couldn't not talk about this. I couldn't not talk about competition and its relationship to collaboration when so many of the structures that are built around, that are supposed to be built around a healthy competition that leads to collaboration, mm-hmm. are falling apart.
Mm-hmm. And you, in a very connected way, but in a really connected way, there was an article came out maybe last year or maybe the year before, and it was about white supremacist groups using MMA gyms to recruit membership. And the journalist whose name is not essential at the moment, we've both written about this stuff, argues that it's almost like there's something inherent in the structure of MMA and combat sports, and that what it is the term violence. And because MMA and other combat sports are, according to this journalist, inherently violent, that's why they become recruiting grounds for the, you know, the alt-right, the far-right, the you know, violent extremists of any kind of political persuasion. And you really took issue with that, didn't you? You jumped up straight away and wrote an impassioned blog post for the Love Fighting Hate Violence post, and you disputed that. Can you explain a little bit about the nature of that argument about the relationship of martial arts to violence?
Sure. That was a blog post. I mean, I get into this in the book as well in a little bit more of a sustained way, but like the central argument and one that I really share with the Love Fighting Hate Violence project is that violence and fighting are different, because fighting is consensual. Fighting is something that two people agree to do. And this is a whole other question, but that's even what separates like a street fight, an altercation from an ambush from an assault. Now, just because something is consensual doesn't mean it's a good idea, right? So I'm just gonna frame that up right away in that, like, you know, getting into a street fight is super problematic for many ways because it's dangerous and because people's consent is not necessarily always freely given, right? And if something is only truly consensual if you can walk away from it and you can stop at any time. And I'm emphasizing that because I think that's also a big problem with combat sport. So I will say that up front too, is that because combat sport is a sport and it's a business, I don't think we're in a situation where the practitioners feel like they could walk away at any moment, that they could say, stop, I've had enough. And in fact, you know, Alex Channon has written about that. Like, there was a fighter, I can't remember the specifics, but an MMA fighter where she was in between rounds, said, "I'm done," mm-hmm. you know, and the coach and the corner man were like, "No, you're not, get back in there." And then that question of like, well, what if she had gotten seriously injured and, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Now, violence is different from fighting because violence is not only not consensual, it's about eroding consent. It's about overriding consent. That's actually what makes it violent. And it's about exterminating the will of another person. If that distinction were simple, if consent were simple, then like we'd be done, right? But then that's not only a question about combat sport, that's a question across the board about, you know, everything from sex to teenage drug experimentation, right? If consent were easy, then, you know, the world would be a much more stable place. And so I think one of the things that happens with combat sport is that because it's a business, mm-hmm. there's a lot of playing around with the line between fighting and violence. You know, things like trash talking, things like trying to build up the idea of a grudge match to like sort of play with this idea of like, maybe it really is real. Maybe this isn't just an athletic competition where people happen to inflict physical damage. Like maybe they really are trying to eradicate each other's wills, right? And so there are all these moments, like the numerous examples with Conor McGregor, right? I mean, there's so many examples of it that I think does show us that combat sports are walking a really fine line, and that line gets blurred a lot. And that, unequivocally, I think is a bad idea. I think if you're going to have sports where there are minimal rules, then that line has to be protected even more so. And I think this has an awful lot to do with the fact that these are businesses, and they do have an economic element. Mm-hmm. Because if we just talked about like, okay, well, these are more violent than other martial arts, then because they allow more options, then you could get into the question, well, like, why not Japanese shooto, for example? Like, or, you know, why not boxing? I mean, boxing has other problems for sure. And boxing as a sport is a business and it does push these boundaries, but we're not seeing like the kind of potential association of boxing and far right fight clubs. So I think what's going, and we could then get into the question of like, well, boxing is associated with African Americans in the inner city. Japanese shooto is from Japan, right? So that's definitely part of it. I think MMA is unmarked culturally, mm-hmm. right? So it allows it to be appropriated in a particular kind of way and to appear white.
Well, I think it's unmarked in a Western context. I think if you are viewing this from, say, China, or yeah. elsewhere in East Asia, then you've got, that's a very culturally marked thing.
But yes, absolutely. So, right, that's like unmarked with the little, with the bunny ears, right? Yeah. That like, right. It appears to be kind of universal, which enables it to be white and to seem white. And then I think just as we could say, oh, the obvious explanation is that these are minimal rule fighting interventions, fighting modalities. The other big thing I think, you know, honestly, is that it's trendy, right? It normalizes white supremacy. And I think the whole thing of the far right fight clubs in the United States, like there's not really clear what the data is on that, but we do know that, for example, there's like the European like white Rex thing. And just like, we see this happening over and over again with these white supremacists and the fascist organizations where they try to normalize themselves. And they try to make themselves seem almost like wholesome. So that's part of their ideology too, is that like, you know, MMA is trendy, it has this sheen to it, and it's athletic, and these people are like thin and fit and they look good, right? So it's a whole process of normalization as well. So I think it's like, there's these like multifaceted elements to that.
Okay. And then, I mean, we've been quite lucky with the Wi-Fi so far and the internet. I don't want to rest on my laurels. So what's next for Professor Janet O'Shea? What's the next thing that we're going to be seeing, hearing, reading? You're all over the internet as well, as you're all over YouTube as well, aren't you, all the time? But
really?
Yeah. Okay. So what's next? What's the next thing in the pipeline?
So right now I'm working on a book tentatively titled Bodies on the Line, Physical Risk and Social Justice. Mm-hmm. So on the surface, this does not appear to have much to connect it to martial arts, nor to dance. But as I said at the beginning of our conversation, what the commonality for me is what actions bodies commit to through their physical practice and what those commitments mean in a broader cultural sense. So I'm in effect taking the conceptual frame of risk failure play and applying it to social justice activism to think about situations where people take physical risks and make themselves vulnerable. But instead of in the play space where like the whole point is there's an absence of a goal, here's something where there's a very clear goal. That is to initiate some kind of change, a policy change or a change in our social structure. And yet in all the examples I'm looking at, process is also really important. So there is this element of the social justice intervention is intrinsically valuable, but it has a goal.
That's fabulous. That's great. I mean, there's so much to say about that. It's like the taking of lessons learned in one field and one study and literally kind of, well, academically, conceptually moving that into like, it's almost like a transferable skill. What people, so people say you can learn these things from martial arts and in martial arts and deploy them elsewhere. And you're doing that with what you've learned in thinking about and studying martial arts. So that's great. But I will say now, Professor Janet O'Shea, thank you very much. It's been excellent talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It's been great talking to you as well.